Hi, I'm Andres Arochi, the cinematographer from Long Legs, and you're watching the Cinematographer Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Well, hey there, Ben Rock.
Sup.
Sup to you. Hey, it's time for another fine episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Who
favorite moment of every week is when we dive into this. And yeah, and I don't mean to brag, but we got an episode today pretty excited about. And then I'm interviewing somebody else tomorrow that I'm not going to say who it is because you never know. Sometimes these things get canceled. Pretty excited about that one. But tonight is Andres Arochi, who shot freaking Long Legs.
Yes, I know you were talking about this for a while, so I'm really glad that
as soon as I saw Long Legs, I was talking about it. I think that was my short end that week, and I was very excited about it. And
ask and you shall receive. Alana Cody bringing the goods, setting this up. So yeah, good.
And I kept thinking about you while I was talking to Andres because you're the one who always has the question of. What percentage plumber and what percentage artist are you?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
This guy is all artist. And all you have to know to figure that out is go to his website and look at his work. Holy crap. Very artistic, very just beautiful composition, beautiful lighting. Like he is such an artist about what he does. And this is his first... this is his first international feature as DP, but he actually shot a feature he also directed that sounds like a lovely, it's called Luto, sounds like a kick-ass feature. But anyway, it's a cool conversation. I love talking to people like Andres who are just like so in the art of it, so fully committed to the art of the work. And I'm really excited to see where he goes from here.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm so glad.
Doors aren't flying off their hinges for him right now. I don't know what it would take because he took, I don't know what the budget of Long Legs was, but I've heard $10 million and that movie was a decent hit for a $10 million movie, but it's like the buzziest horror movie or one of the buzziest horror movies in a year full of buzzy genre movies. So
there's been quite a bit for sure. All right, so Ben, we're going to get into that interview in just a few minutes, but first, in lieu of our usual close focus today, we are going to give away the J. Holbin Shotcraft book. We had a bunch of entries online, and if you're just hearing this now and you didn't enter, sorry for all of you people who did enter. Here's the moment of anticipation. Ben, pick a number between 1 and 433.
Whoa. Okay, hold on 1 second. 1 in 400. I'm going to go with 267.
267. Hold on a second. Let me scroll over there. Beep, boop, bop, boop, beep, boop, bop, boop, beep. And the winner is the Ronnie Marie, who writes, "Love y'all's podcast. Look forward to it every week. Big heart." So there it is. Yeah, thanks, the Ronnie Marie. That was a wonderful thing to say. And our show producer, Alana Cody, will be in touch to get your information, and we will get you your Shotcraft, your autographed Shotcraft book out to you as soon as that's possible. So yeah, we're going to make that happen. Thank you for entering and being a loyal listener. Please tell other people about our show or write us a review or, you know, one of those fun things.
You could like take out a billboard on Sunset Boulevard with our website, camnoir.com.
Yeah, that would be that'd be hardcore. That'd be really hardcore.
I'd be a super fan, I think. A super duper fan.
Well, I think that just about does it then for our beginning part of the show. I know that's a little bit short, but we gave away a book, which is exciting, and we're going to have another book giveaway coming up relatively soon. I've got another person coming on who wrote a book soon, so yeah, we're going to keep this going. It'll be fun.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I love it when we do the book giveaways.
All right, Ben, so you want to take us into the interview?
Here we go. Here's Andres Arochi.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
So thank you so much for coming on the show. Like I said, we're huge fans of Long Legs and the work that you did on Long Legs. And when I first saw it, I saw it with some friends of mine who are, you know, everyone in the business is, you know, yakking about what they know. And they'd said that you were a first-time feature DP. And I looked it up, and I'm, I don't know the exact timeline of your work, but you directed and DP'd a feature before this. But I guess kind of tell me just a little bit about your background pre Long Legs, because, you know, I think for, especially for kind of the world cinema market, like, you're we're not as familiar with your work. I've watched everything on your website, and I think your work is freaking amazing. But you know, like, give me sort of your backstory. What brought you to Long Legs?
So I've been working as a DP for maybe 12, 13 years. Mm-hmm. This is my first actual, like, international feature. But the film you're talking about, it's named Luto. That's a Mexican movie I created and I did with a bunch of friends. It's a very DIY indie project. It's an exploration, like an essay about grief mm-hmm. in Mexico specifically. So it's like a portrait about my country. It's half fiction, half documentary. It's a very experimental film. It's coming out November this year. Oh, so cool. It's a movie I did and shot before Long Legs.
That was my question. Yeah, I didn't know if you had done that first.
But it's a super DIY project, so everything takes much more time. No, of course, there's less money, so post-production took a long time, distribution. Then we did a big festival run, which was the complete opposite as Long Legs. No? Long Legs went straight into cinema. We were shooting, and exactly a year after, we were already reading reviews from the press. So this was a much longer process. I did this movie, I directed and shot it, but there's 2 out of 6 weeks were shot by Galo Olivares, who's a DP in Alien and Greta Van Hansel.
Oh, nice.
He's a great friend, and he's very close to Oz Perkins after they did Greta Van Hansel together. So, yeah, I've been doing music videos and commercials for 10 to 12 years. I directed some. I shot a lot of them. Yeah, I guess I started my career when I was like 17, 16. I started doing live visuals for concerts and started experimenting with mapping, projections, cameras.
Oh, cool. I've done a bit of that. I've done projection design for live shows and stuff.
Nice. Yeah, so that's how I started. All of my friends were musicians when I was in high school. And I never found that talent in music. And experimenting with what was my role and what was my thing inside that micro society, I started taking pictures, and I realized very quickly I had something special there. And everyone was a musician, so I was the only photographer. So I was taking everyone's pictures and doing everyone's album covers and stuff. So it was very, like, immediately pleasing, and, like, I found myself and my voice very fast. I was fortunate enough to find it at a very young age. And then I started working at production companies as a trainee, and I also did a lot of graphic design because I did all this album cover. So I started doing movie posters.
I can see that. Like, again, I've watched all the videos that are on your website. I'm sure that there's, you know, for every one of those, there's 10 that didn't make the cut. But, like, your work has such a graphic design feel to it. Like, it's so specifically composed. And, you know, I mean, again, we've been doing this podcast now for over 10 years, and we've talked to hundreds of DPs. You're the first one on your website. You have a fine art tab. And I thought that was really cool, because it was, like, you know, really kind of beautiful but experimental video stuff that you had shot that was just really, really mind-blowing and gorgeous. Like, you know, it's the kind of stuff you would see in a, you know, a video display at an art museum or something. Like, it's really beautiful stuff.
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. And that's, like, the part of my work that speaks more directly from me and from my heart. And there is definitely a blend from that in my more, like, professional or more serious work, no? You can still see that.
So did you end up going to any kind of a film school or film program or college for this, or did you kind of learn it in the field doing it yourself?
I studied psychology, but I left because I was invited to work on my first feature as a stills photographer. Mm-hmm. I already knew I wanted to do this, but I had to do like the whole family run through college and stuff. And somewhere in my year two of psychology school, I was invited to work in this movie shot in Acapulco with a very cool crew. And it was, for me, it was a no-brainer. It's what I wanted to do. So it was the perfect excuse to tell my parents I wanted to take this path. I've been working on film, I don't know, for 3 or 4 years before that. And I just needed to have like a clear career path for it to be easy with my parents that I was dropping out of school and working on film. But it was my first job.
What was the film that you worked on?
It's a movie, a Mexican movie called I Hate Love. Mm-hmm. From a Mexican director named Humberto Hinojosa, which I was his like personal assistant for several years, and that's how I started to do some B camera work, and I would also AD him or just do graphic design for him. That's where I met some very cool Mexican DPs like Guillermo Garza, and that's how I started to get like really into film, no, and thanks to going on shoots with him, I also realized I wanted to be a DP. No, I was very, very inspired by seeing the DP work and how he played with light. And it's exactly like where I was experimenting with projectors and stuff. It was very similar to using lights, but bigger. And everything seemed huge for me. No, and it's like, how do you start playing with so many lights, with so many cameras, so many toys? So that's where I grabbed the inspiration, and where I immediately fell in love with a craft.
So how does your move to being a cinematographer go? Do you work in the camera department for other cinematographers? Do you go out and, I mean, I've kind of seen, I mean, there's more paths than two, but I've seen two basic paths, which are working your way up to cinematographer or hanging out a shingle and saying, I'm a cinematographer, and you'll work on lower budget stuff and the budgets rise up. Which was your path? Or if it was different, let me know what that was.
I always had two parallel jobs. Like, I was working shooting stills in big sets with big DPs, and it was like the best school ever because I had a digital camera on my hand the whole time. I had I could be right next to a camera. I had like access to all this information, and I specifically, like, I would watch the DP's monitors, see their settings, start copying them on my camera, and start understanding why they're choosing certain things, and looking for frames, trying different lenses. And always I had my parallel career that was the more DIY indie producer that's still happening. No, it's the same. Like, I have Luton, I have Longnecks, and it's this more punky version of myself where I like to shoot with just one camera and take some friends to a volcano and shoot there, no? And I started doing music videos parallel, no? Like, I would work on a big music video as a stills photographer, and the next day I would shoot my friend's music video with $100 and just go to a volcano with a model and shoot something. And slowly they started catching each other. And it was very cool because, like, now big DPs would see the cheap DIY music video I did, and it was like, whoa, that's very cool. I really like this frame, blah, blah, blah. And then they would run into trouble, and it's like, we need a B-cam operator, or we need a second unit. And it's like, just give him a chance. We already know how he frames, how he lights. And they started blending into each other. And I also did a lot of underwater operating. So there was a lot of commercials, like international commercials, coming to Mexico to shoot. And I would fly over to Cancun and do like all the underwater for a lot of very big music videos. And that's how I started meeting a lot of the directors and like starting to network through that area.
How'd you get, I mean, underwater cinematography is very specialized. How did you get into that?
So I guess my dad taught us how to scuba dive when we were like 12, And it was something I was very passionate about when it was like an early teen. I wanted to be a marine biologist, and the ocean has always been a big part of like my passion. So I already knew how to scuba dive when I was very young, and then I had my career as a photographer. And one day, like, a friend of mine told me, like, I want to do this pilot. It's a documentary, like an environmental thing. I have money for this pilot. I've been looking for underwater ops. There's nothing I like. Like, everyone's more like Nat Geo oriented than it's more scuba divers that have cameras than like underwater ops, no? And he told me, like, I know you really know how to scuba dive, and you're a great photographer. Have you tried underwater? And it's like, yeah, I've taken some pictures, like just animals, like a girlfriend diving, and I would just create like very small stuff. So it was like, yeah, like it sounds super easy. I know how to use big cameras, and I know how to scuba dive. It sounds very easy. And we did this documentary, the pilot. Never get picked on, but we had like the pilot was very cool, so I got my underwater reel. So there was something very different because most of the underwater ops are scuba divers that have no artistic sensibility. It's more like always like more scientific or more adventurous stuff. And so when music videos and commercials needed underwater ops, they always went for the more artistic and like sensible reels they saw. So that's how I started doing a lot of work. And yeah, it was a very important moment in my career because that's where I met like very cool directors, and that's where I found like more people doing like interesting stuff in the music video world.
And like what, directors and DPs did you get to work with, kind of previous to you, prior to you kind of breaking through as a DP? Like, who were some of the people you were able to take some inspiration from or learn from when you were on set as a photographer or B camera op or what, or any of those things?
So, I mean, all of this happened in Mexico City, and like the big names were Guillermo Garza, Alexis Sabé, Gal Olivares, and yeah, most of them work in the States now. And there's still people that I really admire. And but in those moments in that part of my life, it was huge just seeing how they worked, because like I didn't come from film school, so I started with like zero clue of what they were doing, no? And it was this moment of my life where, I don't know, in 3 or 4 years I learned more than ever in my life, no? Like, it was that, and going like after a long shoot, a 15, 16-hour Mexican shoot, going back to a computer and researching and seeing like these Vimeo tutorials and trying to understand why the DP did this and that, and like drawing light setups. And it was a very cool moment because I was really absorbing from everywhere. But I never only tried to learn the DP. I've always been like inspired from all the departments. I really like sound, and I really love like the sound design. So I was always playing around with that in the editing room. Like, I always had something for computers. I think since a kid, I had, I don't know, like certain facilities to work with computers, and I always understood how they worked. So I always had like this problem solving. So it was like just finding something that used all of the things I liked, you know? And then when I started adding scuba diving, and then I don't know, hiking, and I love to shoot out in nature, and then I also love working with projectors, so then I use a studio and we do 3D mapping on someone's body, or we use it as a light. And that's
Oh,
where I
wow.
found somewhere where I could explore everything I liked. But I guess the idea, more like besides the technical aspects of it, was playing with light and creating an atmosphere. No, it doesn't matter if it was for a party or for a music video. It was always creating atmospheres. And I think that's where I started to experiment. Also, growing up in such like a big city. I mean, it's a very green city, but it's very urban. And I always love traveling to nature. Yeah.
What
So
city is
there,
that?
Mexico City.
Oh, okay.
And So always like my work has had something to do with nature, and it was big part of like understanding this privilege that I had to travel around, that I always loved bringing images of nature back to this urban city, you know. And that's how like it's part of the same process. Like I bet if I go back and we find one of the pictures of those visuals, and then you see my work right now, you can still tell it's me, no? And it's a very important part of my process.
Well,
But
it's interesting that you bring that up because, like, looking at your work, I mean, there are a lot of DPs we talk to who just disappear into the material and you don't see their fingerprints on it. And then there are DPs like, I don't know, Darius Kanji or Robert Richardson. There's tons of them who, like, you can see a shot of theirs and be like, you can know kind of who it is. Roger Deakins, they're out there.
yeah.
And I feel like, your stuff is definitely in the latter category. And I would encourage anyone listening to this to go check out your website and watch a bunch of your videos. Like, there's a certain texture to it. There's a certain kind of way that you play with color and composition. There's a certain amount of clarity in the midtones. There's a certain kind of darkness you achieve. And it's like I don't know that I could spot it immediately, but as soon as I watch it, I'm like, oh, there's a vibe that you do that's really unique. Like, how did you go about kind of developing that? And it is clearly in Long Legs, by the way.
It's just being honest with yourself, and it's also understanding. I think, like you said perfectly, there's two ways to approach this, and for me the best example is like in the Mexican DP says you have Chivo and you have Rodrigo Prieto, no? Two huge DPs. They're equally as good. Like I couldn't choose one. But if you see a movie from Chivo, you know it's Chivo. And sometimes that's good, but sometimes that's bad, no? And with Prieto, you never know it's him. It's just a great movie, you know? And for me, I think, and this is not a decision, it's just something that what happened in my process. I think I have more this process like Chivo, where I think I work more from my intuition and more from my heart. So there's always a big part of me there, which I always try to fight because as a DP, it's never good to be protagonist, you know. There's certain movies that allow it, but not every movie should have such a protagonist. So I find myself also like lowering my voice or trying to quiet down every time, you know. And it's just in my process, I always had this parallel thing as you said it, as the fine art, which is a process closer to like spirituality than something rational, you know. And like many DPs are just like big camera nerds, and they work like that. And there's beautiful, like Greg Fraser, it's an amazing camera nerd, no? And the way he works, and like I just recently rewatched his Batman, and it's incredible, no? The
Agree.
light,
I
everything,
love it.
it's
I feel like he
incredible.
was robbed. He should have been nominated for that. It was so good.
Yeah, and then for me, Dune is not that great, but then he's nominated. I mean, let's not go into the Academy Awards things, but there's different approaches, but just by seeing his work, I have a feeling I know who he is or a big part of it, no? And for me, it's always trying to be true to that instinct, to your taste, to whatever feels right. And when you do it, then you're talking about yourself, so it's easy that you'll see yourself reflected. And more like we live in a time where a lot of young directors are using references all the time. And I've always fought against that, no? Like Longlegs has a lot of references on the script, and there's all this Silence of the Lambs thing, all this Seven thing, Zodiac
I'm
paradox.
glad you brought it up because it was something that, like, before I even saw the movie, I was hearing comparisons to Silence of the Lambs and comparisons to Seven. And when I saw it, I'm like, yeah, this is its own thing. It's neither of those. I mean, like, those are both masterpieces, and I've seen both of them dozens of times, but, like, this is completely separate. It's a totally different film.
So whenever the script is like, yeah, there's a cipher, yeah, there's something about Seven in there, but it's just Oz's references in his daily life. But the movie, more than that, is just his relationship with his mother, you know, and that's the real meaning of Longlegs, you know. Like Oz told me, this movie is about moms also lie, you know, and moms lie to protect their children. And that's such a powerful thing. And that's where I start working from. And that's where I start exploring and creating a character through the camera work and how I'm going to frame them. And I go back like inside to my personal growth and beliefs to try and feel empathy for these characters and then try to explore through that. And so my references are always like emotional. It's not like, let's copy this frame from this. And then like when you work from there, it's obviously like, there's so much people going on the same direction. It's like, oh yeah, this frame is exactly like this. And it's like, yeah, it's very similar, but I've never seen this before, no? And I guess like when you don't reference a lot and when you don't try to copy and you work from your heart, it's you're always going to be there, you know? And you're always going to see your work as a mirror. That's it.
Yeah. I wonder if the reference thing too is like the industry has become very fixated on lookbooks and pitch decks when you're trying to get a movie made. And in order to get, and before that it was sizzle reels. And I feel like that there's a need to assure whoever you're making it for that it's like something else that was successful that they can look at and they could be like, ah, I get that. And I honestly don't know what Oz Perkins' process was in selling it, but I assume that like most movies, getting it set up was like a process of assuring whoever was paying the paycheck, like this is going to be like something else that you've seen, something else that was successful, and then you get these ideas baked into your head. In the same way that when you're editing, if you don't have a color grade on it, you can fall in love with the temp color grade. You can fall in love with the temp music or sound effects, and you have to like wash that out of your brain before you do it. And I wonder if to a degree as a filmmaker, you have to kind of say, okay, my pitch deck was what got me here, but now let's put that aside and do the job.
It's for me, it's very sad and it's so limiting. It's just people with money being lazy, you know? And it's like, I don't want to take risks. I need to know for sure what this is going to be. This is the next Silence of the Lambs. Okay, I'll give you money. There's no next Silence of the Lambs. Like, what are we talking about? No, that's this. These movies are like some rare thing that happens every 10 years. That has nothing. There's no. What's the first Silence of the Lambs? What's before that? Like The Shining, or I don't know. Yeah. There's nothing in between there. Like these things come out of authenticity, out of someone exploring a limit and going somewhere where no one has gone. And now the money people are being very lazy. They just don't want to imagine things. Like you can tell them 2 + 2 = 4. And it's like, no, but I need to know what's this for. You know, like I need to see it. And it's so limiting because like if you already sold, you're doing the next Silence of the Lambs. And then we want to use pink light. It's like Silence of the Lambs doesn't have pink light. You can't do this. And then it's so limiting that it's like, then we're never going to be as good as Silence of the Lambs because we're just trying to play by its mold, having something different, you know? And for this movie, for Long Legs specifically, it was incredible because we had all the freedom we wanted. It was the movie we shot as in an independent movie. Like after week 3 or 4, it was bought by Neon. But there was no one in the process, like creative. No one was limiting us, ourselves. Oz was always encouraging the whole team, like, do what you feel. You already understand the movie we're doing. Like, just do the best version of you. So that was very, very inspiring. And that created the space for us to create from our hearts and using the best tools we knew. But, like, going back to a reference world, like, in the commercial world, you can see it. It's, you have to show me what you're going to give me back. And it's like, imagine you buy a painting and you meet this gorgeous, like incredible painter, talented painter. I want a painting from you, but tell me how it's going to look. Does it going to have red? Or is it going to have pink? But everything else you liked from him, he did it when he was drunk and he just throwed paint. You're limiting him because then it's like, I want to use pink, but I can only use yellow. So then it's going to suck. Because he's working from this limitation and from fear, you know? And I think that's something like we have to get rid of, you know? Like Pinterest and Vimeo are like hurting so much, like the industry, people are just copying. And I think we have to go back from working with our hearts. And I think this is something that Long Legs has. When I see people saying, I love the atmosphere, I love how it feels, I think they're just feeling the emotions of all the whole crew, no? Like feeling what happened, because being on that set felt that same way as the people are feeling. And yeah, with us, there was no reference. Like, we would talk about movies we like, but it was mostly like Gus Van Sant movies that have nothing to do with this movie, but it's just the aesthetics we like. We talked a lot about music. Talking Heads was a great reference for this movie. Can you see it? I don't know, but it truly was.
Psycho Killer? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, and that's where T-Rex and everything started to come out, no? But I think it's fun also, like, grabbing things. Like, the first time I read Longlegs, I sent him the Magritte painting where he has an apple in his face.
Love that painting, so, yeah.
It was like the idea that we can't see Longlegs in the beginning, no? So I think that an artist's soul needs that. For him to have a process, and when something big comes, and when you're doing a Hollywood movie, if you find a way to put a little view of a little seed, I think that's something beautiful and very poetic.
So how do you like to get a little practical about it though? Ilya, my co-host on this, would often kind of use the plumber versus artist comparison, and you know, would kind of talk to DPs and say, you know, like, what percent artist, what percent plumber are you? And I feel like in talking to you, you're definitely landing in the artist camp, but you know, we all have to be plumbers to a certain degree, in that you have to, you know, make your day and plan out what kind of gear you need and all that stuff. So how do you take like all of these amazing intuitive creative ideas that you have that are apparent in your work, how do you take them and kind of synthesize them down to like the strategy of how you're going to shoot the movie in X number of days, and how you're going to get through all the scenes that you have to get through and all that stuff? How do you meet the art with the strategy part of the job?
I think there's another subdivision, which is like emotional.
Mm-hmm.
No, because there's like the artistic part of it. There's the technical part of it, but I also truly believe in the emotional one. And I think as a DP, sometimes you have the chance to pick, we're shooting this in the morning, or we're shooting this in the afternoon, or let's make this night, or let's make this an exterior. And I always have to think of the emotional part of it, and not my emotional part of it, the emotional part of the crew or of the actors. No? How do I create the right atmosphere? It's like using a light. If I use a light right next to you, or I put the camera very close to you, I'm going to make the actor feel something. It might distract him, we might provoke him, but you always have to be conscious of that. No, it's if we all go to a night shoot, I know the crew will work very differently. They're going to be more quiet, but they're also going to be tired. They're going to be slower. And you have to think of all this that's happening in a human level, no, which a lot of people now these days forget. But we're always working with humans, and it's always a collaboration. So we always have to be mindful of that. And if the shot is going to look perfect if I put this light right here, but it's going to harm the actors, it's going to harm their performances, then fuck it. There's going to be a shadow there, but we'll have great performances, no? I am highly technical. Of course, my job is highly, highly technical, and I'm always researching that. But I think it's part of something I also like, no? Like, I also love speakers, and I love monitors, and I love TVs, and I love like electronic gadgets, because I've always liked that, no? And it's part of the same thing. When you're bored and you're online looking at a new camera, a new sensor, a new TV, a new projector, it's as easy as that, I guess. I think it's more like, the more important thing is like, what do I have to say? What do I want to create? And then you find the technical way to do it. But also like the shooting is such a collaborative part that if you know what you want to do, you imagine how something is going to look, you're surrounded by people who knows. And it's not only the people on set, it's just your DP friends. It's your friend that, it's an artist, whatever. It's just a phone call. No, it's like, I really want to do this. I want to bounce a huge light in the middle of a forest. Can you pick it up on a drone? It's like, do I research and go online? Yeah, someone has done it. But then it's like, okay, I have this friend who has a drone and this guy can do that. I call them and research. And it's a big part of it, no? Like researching. But it makes no sense if you have nothing to say, no? Like it has to come from something inside you that says, I want to do that or I want to create this. And then you find a technical way how to do it. So, of course, I can't say I'm not technical. There's a lot of technical aspects on the job.
No, I'm not implying that, but I feel like for some people, like you were saying, some people are, you know, into camera gear and into the technology mm-hmm. of it, and they find the art in that. And I feel like you're in talking to you, clearly you're coming from it from, like, you know, like you said, an emotional place, and you're yeah. figuring out the technology to kind of support the emotion. And I think that's it's a fascinating thing, and I feel like we don't talk about that as much because I feel like not as many people are working that way. And again, I feel like it really shows in your work, because like every frame of your stuff, I feel it's one of those things where, you know, like you would say it about Chivo, like every frame of his thing, you could hang that on the wall as a piece of art. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's it's really interesting. But it makes me wonder, like, when you read Long Legs, did you have... Was it like, oh, cool, I get to shoot a movie, you know, and have, you know, like a decent budget. I don't know what the budget was, but have a budget to work with, be working with movie stars, yada, yada. Or did you, when you read that script, did something about that script really talk to you?
I guess it was the dialogues. Like, there's some dialogues in this script and in this movie that I just thought they were, like, very... authentic. Like, specifically after I just shot my movie Luto, and then I read this script, and it's like the hardest thing in writing is, for me, it's dialogues, no? And this is what I suck at, and I'm a very visual guy, of course, so dialogues are my opposite. It's where I have no idea. It's when things become way too rational for me, and my mind doesn't really work there. And when I read the script, it's like, wow, this guy really knows how to work in that thing that I don't know how to do. I love the comedy factor. Like, I've never seen, like, these gags or this comedy inside a horror film, no? And we never talked about it as a horror film. It was always more of a thriller, but still, there was, like, this comedy and this, like, spark to it. And when I met Oz, it's like, this is you, man. Like, this is how he talks. He's a hilarious guy. He has, like, this... huge charisma. He's always saying, I'm not good with people, but he's truly one of the best persons I know. Like, he yeah. everyone loves him, and he's just funny, and he's honest, and you can see that in his dialogue. So I think the thing that captivated me more about this script was that it's like exactly this that I can't do, there's someone that does it greatly. Mm-hmm. I think we can something great together, and I think that's what happened, and that's how we complimented each other.
And was there a sense of, like, I'm sure he watched a bunch of your stuff, of like talking to you about the feelings, the framing, the lensing of some of your previous work, that like how you would go about bringing that to this?
I mean, exactly the opposite of what I was saying earlier. As people are afraid of, like, I have to see what I'm buying. Oz was the opposite. Oz heard and talked to me, and Gallo told him about me, and he bought it, and he didn't have to see much. He saw Luto like a work in progress cut I had. He saw some of my music videos, and he just went with his gut, and he said yes. And I think that's something I'm always gonna be grateful to him, because, like, I know he took a very big risk, no, flying over this young DP that has no movies, and I think that's incredible, and I think that's something that more directors need, like those guts and those like that honesty to yourself and saying, this is what my instinct tells me, I'm gonna do it, and fuck it, like I'm taking risks. And I think that's something beautiful about a director, when they take risks, because Of course, like you can always hire, like if you can pay for Darius Kanji, then have him, no? But if you want to really stand out and if you want to make something new, then try new people. There's like, it's just how it is, no? Like you have to experiment, and of course you have to make sure you're not going to risk it too much where you're going to make the project fail. But I think that that's something beautiful that he took that risk with me. And
no, it's interesting. Like we had talked to Mihai Malimari years ago when he did Jojo Rabbit, and he started out working for Coppola, and Coppola basically, I don't know if he was a first time feature DP, but he had never worked with anyone on the level of Coppola when he did, I think Youth Without Youth was the first one. And, you know, the work is incredible. And then, you know, now he shot Megalopolis. So, you know, like, you know, Coppola and he stuck together, but yeah, it's interesting to, I mean, like it is a risk. I feel like looking at your work, I wouldn't feel like it was much of a risk because your work is so accomplished, but, you know, when you came to kind of breaking Long Legs down, you know, like how did you guys approach kind of how you created the look of Long Legs? Correct me if I'm wrong, because I saw it when it came out twice that week. But doesn't the aspect ratio change a couple of times?
I mean, there's two aspect ratios. There's two complete, like we shot the two movies. No, one's based in the 1970s. We shot on film. It's all 4x3.
Yeah.
We shot on 35mm film. And everything else in the 1990s, it's with an Alexa Mini LF, and it's 2:39 aspect ratio. So originally, Oz wanted to shoot the whole movie on film, and we were very happy about it. We were very excited, but the producers were very worried. So then it's like we're bringing this young DP that doesn't have any movies, and now we're going with film. The other big production that was happening in Canada, like right before this, it was Dream Scenario, also with Nicolas Cage.
Yeah.
And they had so much trouble shooting with their 16mm camera. Like their lenses were decollimated. I don't know the word in English. They were having some trouble with that. There was some out of focus scenes. Still, if you see the movie, it's a great movie. I love it.
But that's not a problem with film. That's a problem with your fucking lenses.
With your lenses. Yeah, but they didn't know about this until they get the dailies. There's no labs in Canada, so it flies to LA and then you get your film back. And when you have the dailies, it's 3 or 4 days after. So there's nothing to do about it. And when you shoot digital, there's a problem with your lenses. You know it immediately.
I guess so that's
Nicolas
true.
Nicolas Cage was also worried. Like when the first conversation he had with us, it's like, hey man, like I'm not sure. Like I'm not sure we want to do this on film. So Oz got very nervous.
It's so weird to me that film has become the risky thing to use. That like film is now the experimental risky thing because it was, you know, the standard for 100 years.
Yeah, but things worked very, very differently. Like it was much more common having 2 weeks of reshoots back in the day because you needed them. And all the production worked towards that. There was much more labs. You had a lab in your city. So at the end of the day, you would go to the lab and you could watch your dailies. And right now it's like someone's flying with cans. You have a PA flying with cans to LA and taking it to a lab and 3 days after.
I get it.
I love it. And I'm always going to fight for it. But I don't think it's right for every project because like, if people are going to be afraid, then they're not going to let me work.
No, I know, but like, I don't know if you saw Strange Darling, but we had Giovanni Ribisi on who shot that. And like the first card on that movie is shot on 35mm film. Like, like before the movie starts, like definitely check it out. And it looks great. I mean, like he did an amazing job. But like, I wonder if it's kind of coming back around. So like, what was the ultimate decision then to shoot the 1970s flashback stuff on film and shoot the other stuff on the Alexa?
So we wanted to have the producers relaxed and like comfortable with the decisions we were making and that we weren't taking too many risks for them. But we didn't want to lose that artistic part of it. So I just came up with the idea and I pitched it to us. What if we do the 1970s like this? And he just saw a picture. I don't remember if it was a Polaroid I was taking some medium format pictures. I recently found one I took of him in the Scouts. and I asked for an open gate scan, which shows you the edges of the film, no? And with this medium format film, it's around curves. So when I pitched him this idea, he immediately saw it, and he saw it in his face, a picture I saw showed him that morning. He says, yes, yes, but please let's have the rounded edges. And it's like, yeah, cool, let's do that. I love it. And then we found that we had this chance to experiment with... He has this thing that Gretel and Hansel feels way too artsy for a horror film. And a lot of people had this rejection to it, which I think it's an incredibly beautiful film. It's one of my favorite photographies in the history of the last 20 years of film. It's a beautiful film that didn't get the success it deserved. So it was like this thing that we do want to make something artsy, but we do want to have something for the masses, for the big audiences. So then it was like, okay, cool, let's do that. Let's do the 1990s. Let's go with how this like early Fincher, like this 90s thrillers looked like. Let's go through that. Let's create the modern version of that. But let's shoot the 70s as like this old horror movies, no? And let's go more artistic, and let's frame, and let's go 4x3. And it was very cool because the set sometimes in the same day we would do both. In the morning we would shoot film, and in the afternoon we would shoot digital. And the approach of everything was completely different. So that was very fun. It was sort of like role playing.
That's cool. That's really cool. I didn't know that you shot any film in it. And I guess I've gotten to a jaded point in my life where I assume most films are not shot using film. But I mean, you know, also it looks so good. But I know you can do so much in a grade, and also, you know, sure. what an Alexa or any Venice. There's so many great cameras out right now that you can get an amazing picture out of.
But back to the emotion, when you have a film camera and you have that noise there, everyone reacts differently. And more now that people are nervous about it, it really has an effect on the set. Like the camera team works so much more precise. Like they're not extra confident it's digital. If something fucks up, we'll fix it. Everyone's working focused, precise. You have this beautiful poetic sound of the camera just rolling.
No, I agree.
The actors know it. It changes the emotion.
You don't do that shit where you just leave the camera rolling and reset and do the same thing and do five takes in one take, which is easy to do digitally, but in film it's like, no, I'm not going to leave the camera rolling for a minute while we reset. We're going to cut and we're going to start over again. To me, that sound is the sound of my bank account emptying. Like I just feel the money pouring out as I'm hearing that camera roll, you know?
And you rehearse. But sometimes people think that rehearsals are for actors. Rehearsals are for everyone.
Yeah.
No, and film makes you have to rehearse. And I think that makes things so much better. Like so much better. I guess I'm just very excited that people are opening themselves to go back to theaters. Like I think this year, people, like especially this summer, people really went back to theaters. And I really love that. I like that people are tired of sequels, spin-offs, like just reading the comments on like the trailers and stuff. It's like, it doesn't matter if you like Longlegs or not, people went to see it. And I think that's beautiful. And I think it's, we as an audience and as film lovers, we have to give more pressure to the studios to create original content. That it's what everyone wants, no? Like, of course, there's a huge mass that wants to see Fast and the Furious 12, but there's also a big, big, big audience for films like Longlegs, and that's incredible to see. For me, like the successful outcome of Longlegs is that it's seeing that there's an audience that cares more than the money or anything. So I don't know. I think it's, I hope and I feel there's gonna be like a big comeback of original content.
God, I hope you're right. I mean, I feel like I've been seeing this more and more lately, and Longlegs is kind of a big part of it, is that, you know, instead of make everything having to be an Avengers sequel, I'm not trash in those movies. If you like that, you know, it's always there. But like the middle class of Hollywood kind of fell away for a while, and we weren't making movies that were in the, say, $20 to $50 million range, aiming to make, you know, $100 million. You know, if you make a movie for $10 million and it makes $60 million, that's a huge return on your investment. And yeah, it didn't make $1 billion, but they don't all have to be that. And I, you know, to me, as a movie lover, like I want to go see stuff like this that's going to be challenging and different. And you know, like I don't know every beat of the movie before it starts. And that's kind of what I appreciate about all the movies I just listed, actually.
yeah, it's that. And it's also funny seeing how people are also, sometimes the audiences have the handbrakes, and it's like, wait, this is not like Silence of the Lambs. I don't like this shit. It's like, did you really expect to go and see Silence of the Lambs again? Go and watch Silence of the Lambs, or go and watch Avengers 8. But if someone's trying to do something different, it doesn't matter if you like it or not. It's perfectly okay to hate things, but it's we have to put more pressure and to create more spaces where artists can talk and be true to themselves and express themselves. And this doesn't have to go deep. It doesn't have to be a long, boring 3-hour movie. It just has to be something authentic. And let's see a new superhero, like that didn't come from DC, like, or Marvel, no? Like let's open ourselves to some new things. And I think as an audience, we do have responsibility on that. And we have to understand that, yeah, it's easy to watch Avengers and it's going to be fun and you can eat popcorn and have a great 2 hours of your Sunday. But we also have to push ourselves to try and make an effort to see movies that are going to create an emotion in ourselves. And sometimes you don't like it, but sometimes you have, it's like reading a book. There's books that you just read through it and it's beautiful, but there's books that make you think and make you go to places where you're not comfortable, but they're going to make you grow. And we have to put ourselves in those moments outside of our comfort zone, no? As audiences.
That's awesome. Well, thank you very much for doing that. So before we go, where can people find you online if they want to see more of your work? Obviously, I know because I've been looking at it, but where can people find you online?
My webpage, it's andresarochi.com. I guess you can write it somewhere. It's AndresArochi. And that's my Instagram as well.
Yeah, you have it there. Like if you click on diary, it goes to your Instagram. Well, again, thank you so much. And congratulations on Long Legs. And I can't wait to see what you do next. And, you know, please come back and talk to us again.
Yeah, sure. Happily. And thank you for having me.
All right, so that was Andres. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Cannot wait to see what you do next. Long Legs is now on demand, I believe. And in my humble opinion, damn worth seeing, especially it's spooky season right now. It's, you know, it's October, but it's just a damn cool horror film. Worth your time. And his work is just amazing. And also just go to his website. Good God, go to his website and look at his work. His work is so good.
Yes, indeed. Please go check it out. You can find his website on the show notes over at camnoir.com. Ben, you'll never guess what time it is right now.
I'm not going to say the same joke. What time is it, Ilya?
It's time.
No, I'm not going to recycle my same dad joke.
Please. Thank you. Thank you for resisting the urge right there. It's time to pay the bills. We got to thank our fine friends over at Aputure. Aputure, makers of all kinds of cool lighting products for the motion picture and television industries. One of their newest items, which is not yet released, they call Infinimat. And I want to bring attention to it because more information is coming soon and they're going to be releasing it. And I have seen the Infinimat in person a few times. CineGear Atlanta was just over. I'm sure just happened. I'm sure that they had it out there as well. I've saw it at the last several trade shows, but the Infinimat is this inflatable linking version of RGB flat panels that come in sizes 1x2, 1x4, 2x4, 4x4, 8x8, and 20x20. So you can have some pretty big inflatable lights, and the inflation sort of system creates a bit of diffusion. So it's, and you could also then raise it up above people, and I guess it's you know, got some built-in padding if anything was ever to
but
know.
But it's basically just like a huge softbox.
They're big soft boxes, but they can also be small. They can be 1x2. 1x2 is the size of, like, you know, a small you know, aperture panel light type of thing. So it's seems to be configurable, and it involves a bunch of different of these panels, and the boxes can be adapted together and change the size, and then you can inflate and deflate to pack it up. It's very, very clever. Now, they don't have all of the details yet, but you can sign up on the website for more information. We have a pre-order list going on over at Hot Rod as well, too, if someone wants to get added to the pre-order list. We can. It's more of an interest list right now because nobody knows what the prices are. We don't know what this is going to cost. We don't know what's going to come out.
It's what I always ask you, too. I always want to know, what's it going to set me back?
Yeah, that the website says more information coming Q2 2024. Pretty sure we're in Q3 now. So they're a little bit behind on that. I bet that after this episode drops, though, they quickly update this. They probably put some more information in there, and we'll but it's something to watch. It's kind of a clever new thing. So if you are curious about the Infinimat, you can find it over at aperture.com/products/Infinimat, and we will put a link to that in the show notes.
Can I give an unsolicited plug for Aperture that has nothing to do with the ad you just did?
No. Yes, of course. Yeah.
No, literally yesterday I directed a very small shoot. Basically, it was interactive video for an escape room up in Seattle that my friend Seth Wolfson runs. And I can't say what it is. And if I said what it was, you would know what it was. But years ago, I did one for their Evil Dead 2 escape room. This is IP that's way bigger even than that. So we were shooting at this place in Burbank called Butcher Bird Studios. Are you familiar with them?
I know Butcher Bird. Yeah. They're clients of Hot Rod Cameras, of course. Yeah, Stephen Calcote over there. Very cool guy. I've known him for years. And he's a wonderful supporter and fan of everything we do.
Well, and we were working with a guy named Travis Stevens, who is one of the people who, I guess, runs the facility. I don't know what anyone's position is, but he was our site rep, basically, and basically lit the whole project for us as a site rep. Yeah. And like, man, oh man, but it was all Aperture lights. Like I don't think I saw a non-Aperture light all day. And we're shooting up against a pretty big green screen that they have. There are places in LA where it's like a small office in a strip mall where they, you know, buy a green screen on eBay and throw it up and charge you $700 a day to shoot there.
Oh, not Butcher Bird. They have a real space. Oh yeah, for sure.
They've got
a
great, great green screen psych that is pre-lit, looks amazing. And today, we used their C300 to film everything on. And today I threw it into After Effects and the key like popped out like butter. It was really just an amazing experience, but I just kept kind of being in awe of Aperture's relative takeover of all of that, and thinking about, like, even 10 years ago, if I was shooting in a space like that, well, it probably would have been Kino flows and incandescent lights, and the room would have been uncomfortably hot. And here we are shooting in October, which is like the August of Los Angeles, and
pretty much, and
it was like 100 degrees outside, and we were chilling out in Butcher Bird, which is a great facility, by the way. And like all these Aperture lights put out virtually no heat, and Travis was kind of dialing in the lights with his iPad and sometimes his phone even, and it was just I'm just really blown away and impressed with kind of the ecosystem that Aperture has created, because, you know, you go to NAB or whatever and you see a lot of companies. The first time you see a company like Aperture, you're like, cool, I don't know. And now here we are, I don't know, probably more than 10 years since I saw them there. And it's like, holy crap. Like they really are the goods.
Yeah. They're doing well. So, anyway, so
you probably sold Butcher Bird most of those lights anyway.
And now Short Ends.
It's possible. Yeah, for sure. So Ben, it is our short end time of the show. It's the time we talk about our pet obsession. Do you have an obsession this week? What are you all about?
That sounded very therapeutic.
Tell me about your mother.
I want to talk about a short film that has already gotten a lot of views. And it's been on X, it's been on Facebook, it's all over the place. And like, I've been following and interacting with an actor on Twitter, a guy named Luke Barnett, and he made a short film called The Crossing Over Express. It's like a 12-minute short that he wrote and directed with somebody named Tanner Thomason. And I definitely want to shoot out the DP, whose name is William Helmuth. If you're listening to this, there's probably a reasonably good chance you've seen this. It's very buzzy. I want to say Stephen King said something positive about it. I remember Patton Oswalt said something positive about it. Like, all these people are kind of coming out of the woodwork, and it's kind of it's not a horror film, but it is supernatural. And I don't want to really get into the nitty gritty of it, because I don't want to ruin kind of what makes it magic. And you can find it on YouTube. You can find it everywhere. But it's about someone who wants to talk to their dead mother, and they kind of have this, a way to do it, let's just say. And it's really moving. It's just a goddamn good short. And Luke Barnett is also the lead actor in it, and he's wonderful. And it looks great. It doesn't look like it needed to be made for $50 million. It is at the scale that it needs to be very effective. And it's just a very emotional, moving, well-made short. If you're listening to the sound of my voice and you're thinking about making a short film, you should check this out. It's very effective. And not only is it effective, but it's kind of gone viral. And I'm happy to see an actual cinematic thing go viral, as opposed to, somebody's cat with a Hitler mustache, or, somebody pooping in a hot tub or something. Did I just age myself? That's all very like internet 2003.
Pooping in a hot tub was a thing.
Well, yeah, there was a viral video that got passed around at one time. Oh, God. I know. I just totally dated myself. Cause like, yeah, it's like, what's viral now? You know, it's some Jamoke in Branson, Missouri, talking on TikTok about geopolitics, you know, but I'm glad to see somebody taking craftsmanship and like making a really good thing and putting it out in the world, and it actually being fucking received for a change. Like, it just warms my heart, and it's a really good film, and I hope it means big things for everyone involved. It's just solid, solid, good, emotional, character, wonderful work. I think you'll love it. I can't imagine someone who doesn't like it.
All right, cool. Yeah, I'm interested.
I'm not saying it's everything to everyone, because nothing is, but I feel like it's just it's just wonderful. Anyway.
Yeah, it sounds cool. I'll check it out.
So how about yourself? What has your week been all about?
Well, I really wanted to go see Joker 2, and I still want to see Joker 2, and I still will see Joker 2, but I've got to admit I'm having some trepidation right now, just because the reviews have been not good. They have been universally poor, and it seems that the audience score has also been quite poor. So there's not too many movies that I have been looking forward to for such a very, very long time that
it's not like it was directed by the guy who made The Hangover and then The Hangover Part 2.
But he also directed by the same guy who made Joker. And I thought Joker was a freaking masterpiece. I thought it was so really, really incredible. It was like, it was a dark.
I think Todd Phillips is a really good director, but I also agree. Sometimes not.
Okay. Well, I think.
Look, it looks like a wild swing. I haven't seen it yet. From what I can tell, it's like, if there wasn't enough singing and dancing in the first Joker for you, they really got you covered in this one. It seems like there's a lot of dancing. Oh my God. And I remember when I saw the first Joker, I liked it a good bit.
But you thought there was too much dancing?
I was like, how many slow motion Joaquin Phoenix dancing scenes do I need in my life? But I mean, like, it's not that they're bad, but there were a lot of them. I'm kind of interested in it. I don't know. You know what I think is interesting about what's going on, the conversation around Joker, is that everyone's saying it was a flop, and because it was tracking to make like 60 million or 55 million domestically, and it made 37 million. But as far as I can tell, it made 120 million if you include foreign. And I'm like, how is that a flop? By what metric? I mean, it was a $200 million movie, which seems like a lot for that movie. But
It does seem like a lot.
But the original one made $1 billion, and you kind of go
$1 billion. I mean, if you lump these things together, I mean, it's still, the series is very profitable. Extremely profitable.
And Lady Gaga is not an insignificant star. You know, she's a big deal. I hear people really like her work.
It's interesting because my local theater has on the marquee now a segment from the New York Times review, which is a dour, unpleasant slog. Which, you know,
well,
I mean, that's certainly one way to market your movie. That's certainly one way to try to get people to
come. Next time you're in town,
I'm going to go see it. So.
I'm just going to go ahead and pitch this to you. Next time you're in town, that's you and me do a double feature, Joker 2 and Megalopolis.
Isn't Megalopolis like 3 hours?
It's only 2.5 hours. It's actually not that long.
Okay. I'm in. Yeah, if we can.
I've been dying to see Megalopolis, and I've heard the craziest, wildest swings in both directions on what Megalopolis is.
I'm in town next week, so absolutely, you put a pin in your calendar for next weekend. So weekend after this one, we will do this. We will 100% do a double feature of Joker 2 and Megalopolis is
still in the theater. I hope I've been wanting to go to Megalopolis at my local Regal, and I don't know if anyone wants to stalk me at the Sherman Oaks Regal. You're welcome to do it. When my son goes to sleep, I have a Regal subscription. Sometimes I'll go to a movie at like 9 o'clock at night, and Megalopolis is only playing at like 10:40. And I'm like, I'm not going to go see a movie on a weeknight that starts. And that's like at a half an hour of a trailer. So it's really starting at 11:10, two and a half hours. And it's like, that movie better be like, not like I went and saw like when they brought Old Boy back. I saw that at that screening, but it takes a lot to get me out the door to watch a movie at 10:40. Holy crap. But I want to see it. It just looks nuts. Sorry. I didn't mean to steal your close focus.
It's got to be in the theater for at least 2 weeks. So yeah, I'll be in, you know, not this weekend, but the weekend after. We'll 100% do this. So now
hopefully
the entire world knows where we're going to be and knows what we're going to be doing in 2 weeks. Ben, I think that just about does it for this episode. Where can people find you if they want to reach out to you outside of this show?
Clearly, you can find me usually after 9 p.m. at the Regal,
in
Sherman Oaks. You can find me at benrock.com, and you can check out my reel. I should probably update it one of these days, but check out my reel, check out my, you know, my socials, whatever. Drop me a line on something. Say hi. People do that. Always appreciated. And if you're not a weirdo, I'll follow you right back. Anyway, so Ilya, where can people find you?
Can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com, now in Burbank, California, and Portland, Oregon. So
you're open in Portland. You're fully open.
Stop saying fully open.
You say you can find me at Portland,
Oregon. You can find me there, but it's kind of like you have to know the secret knock, and you know, you can just pick up the phone.
I mean, that's like the Burbank one. It's not like you can just walk. If you were driving down the road, you would not know that Hot Rod Cameras was there.
That's 100% true. You have to know where you're going. But I would say that Portland is even maybe more so. The big sign is not, there is no big sign. So
is there a hollow log or a troll or?
There's something very Portland about it. There's a Sasquatch out front. No, that's not true.
Yeah.
Really what you have to do is we have limited unposted hours at the moment. So by appointment, we are open by appointment. That's what we're doing.
Got it. Has Toby Wilkins come by yet?
Toby Wilkins, yeah, offered me his table saw, and I borrowed his table saw to help build the place. So yeah, fantastic. Yeah, he was a huge help. I really appreciate Toby Wilkins.
We all need more Toby Wilkins in our life. All right, Ilya. So let's get to thanks. Who do we need to thank for this episode?
Let's thank Michael Dispenza, whose job certainly couldn't have been easier this week. So thank you, Michael, for chopping and slicing and dicing and putting this whole thing together.
All right.
Let's thank Kay Zalatracci, Kay's who makes the music that you heard in the show, our fabulous